coming to you from the AT&T Podcast Studio. This is Long Story Short. I'm Ted Struley, the Executive Director at Oklahoma Watch. We're a statewide nonprofit news organization that specializes in investigative reporting. You're listening to our weekly podcast, which lets you hear directly from our journalists as they provide deeper insight into their recently published stories. Heather Warlick covers evictions, homelessness, and housing for Oklahoma Watch, and she recently covered a tragic eviction case in Oklahoma City that made nationwide news. Heather, what happened in the case of Anthony and Mary Golding and their eviction?
Well, Ted, it's actually a really shocking story. Basically, Anthony and Mary Golding, ages 82 and 77, were evicted from their Oklahoma City home by Mrs. Golding's son. And when the two sheriff deputies arrived to forcibly remove the elderly couple, Mr. Golding apparently decided he would rather light himself on fire than be forced to leave his home.
Now, there was body cam video that was released of the incident. Those are public record. What did the video show?
Well, it showed the two deputies entering the home, and it seemed like they were pretty comfortable in the situation. You know, they do enter a lot of very dangerous types of situations, so this grandma-grandpa house probably seemed fairly safe. And at one point, you do see Mr. Golding with a red gas can. He's pouring gas outside of the back bedroom, and then he sort of sequesters himself in that bedroom, pours gas around himself, and lights a lighter and bursts into flames. You see the deputies back off, realizing the fire is chasing them down the hallway, and they proceed to drag Mrs. Golding out of the burning house.
Now, how did you happen to get involved in this particular story?
Well, I actually happened to meet Mr. Golding at the Oklahoma County District Courthouse in the eviction court area right after he had been through his eviction hearing. He told me he'd just lost his eviction case. He believed he had 48 hours to move out of his home. He did not have any legal assistance. He and I sat down and called 211 and wrote down all the different agencies that offered housing assistance. And then I connected him with Legal Aid Services, who said they would try their best to negotiate some extra time for Mr. Golding and Mrs. Golding to get out of the house if they couldn't do more to help. So then Mr. Golding wanted to call his ride home to Mrs. Golding, and it did turn out that he stayed in touch with Legal Aid.
All right. Well, you did also along the way speak to Tim Denny, who had filed the eviction. What did you find out from Tim?
Yeah. So a couple of days after I met Mr. Golding, I tracked down Mr. Denny. He was fairly open in talking to me and also pretty adamant that Mr. Golding was enabling Mrs. Golding and that she was drinking herself to death. He said he had tried to get Adult Protective Services involved to no avail. He told me that he and his siblings had done everything they could think of, and evicting his mom and her husband were the only thing they could think of to do next. So they really were trying to force them to relent and get into skilled nursing or care like that. And honestly, there was really no love lost between Mr. Golding and Mr. Denning, the stepson and stepfather in this case.
So, you know, this was a rather extreme outcome as evictions go. What stood out to you about this one?
It's just such a commentary on the desperation some people feel when it comes to staying in their homes. In this case, there was such animosity and lack of communication in the family, it seems like. And so often I'm seeing that exact animosity and lack of communication between landlords and tenants across the board. Also, there's some new research out that's pretty enlightening as to evictions. Eviction Lab is showing now that chances of premature death are higher if you're not able to keep up with your rent and you're evicted. A study out of Spain shows a correlation between suicide and eviction. So, you know, it's just really shines a light on the fact that, unfortunately, deadly outcomes are a real possibility when it comes to forcibly removing someone from their home.
And what about Mary Golding? How is she doing?
Tim Denny says Mary Golding is doing well. She is in a skilled nursing facility, just like Tim and his siblings were trying to get her to. And he said that if she works hard, she might be able to make it to an assisted living center.
All right. Well, thanks, Heather. You can read Heather's story about the Goldings' eviction and what all went on there. You'll find it on our website, oklahomawatch.org. Reporter Paul Moniz has continued to follow the fallout to Oklahoma utility customers from a massive winter storm that occurred more than 3 years ago. Now there have been some developments involving the Oklahoma Attorney General. Paul, first off, maybe you can remind us what happened during Winter Storm Uri.
Yeah, so this was a huge winter storm that blanketed basically the central part of the United States over President's Day weekend in February 2021. We had really extreme cold temperatures in Oklahoma, ice, snow. Other states like Texas had blackouts. People died from the lack of heat and electricity down there. And then we saw natural gas prices in Oklahoma on the spot market rise to $1,200 during that storm in Oklahoma. That was from a previous price of about $3 in the days before the storm. So utilities basically had to pay that storm cost back from natural gas, and they're spreading that out over several years in things called ratepayer-backed bonds.
Now, what is Attorney General Gentner Drummond doing now?
Yeah, so Drummond filed a pair of lawsuits in Osage County on behalf of the Grand River Dam Authority. That's a public power agency that serves about 24 counties, and it's also its biggest customer is Google, a data center in Mays County. He filed them against Enable subsidiaries, which is a midstream company and pipeline company, and then also another company called Symmetry Energy Solutions. He said basically alleged that they manipulated their parts of the natural gas pipeline systems in the state to boost the prices before and during the storm.
Now, it's been, as we mentioned, more than 3 years since the storm occurred. The rate issue has been in the news almost monthly since then. Why has it taken so long to see any kind of legal action brought?
Yeah, so during the storm, obviously, people saw the prices go sky high, and they were like, what's going on with this? Oklahoma was fairly unique in terms of it went way higher in our region than it did in any other part of the country that had storms from Winter Storm Uri. But essentially, the first things had to happen was the companies had to get paid back for their natural gas. Utilities had to pay that back as well. It went through regulatory processes. They sold bonds to pay this back. Customers were paying back those. So those are kind of done. Legislature stepped in and helped kind of pad the way for enabling these utilities to do these bonds. But, you know, at the same time, the big question from our coverage over the years has been, why did prices get so high? And last summer, Attorney General Gentner Drummond basically said, look, we're going to hire outside counsel to help us investigate why the prices went so high. We're now seeing the first of several lawsuits planned by the Attorney General on these price issues.
Now, like in any civil case, the plaintiff files a complaint and the defendant has a chance to respond. What did the companies say?
Yeah, they basically said one of the companies got back to us in terms of the deadline. And they said, look, we were affected by Uri 2. We had to pay a lot of money for these costs. They'll fight it vigorously in court. The other company said that basically they're going to do the same thing and that they don't agree with the allegations at all.
Now, these aren't the only lawsuits that have been filed involving natural gas prices, right?
That's right. Several utilities themselves have filed lawsuits. There's a utility down in San Antonio, Texas, a public municipal utility that's filed in the Texas market on natural gas prices. We had one small utility here in Oklahoma that's regulated by the Corporation Commission, Arkansas Oklahoma Gas, has a couple thousand customers in Oklahoma, a little bit more in Arkansas. They took on energy giant BP over some of these costs and cancellations of contracts during the storm and won and got a judgment on that. So their customers are benefiting a little bit from that. Also, there's been a kind of multiple lawsuits involving customers in Texas, basically on an individual level, alleging manipulation by some of these companies down there. And of course, our neighbor to the north in Kansas, their attorney general last year filed a lawsuit against a natural gas trader called Macari. and basically alleged that they manipulated the price on the market during that time. That is still pending up there, and McCary has denied allegations in that lawsuit.
Well, what did Drummond tell you about this pair of lawsuits?
Yeah, so Drummond basically said, look, we knew there's been bad actors. He has said from the beginning he doesn't believe Oklahoma Utilities acted wrongly. He doesn't believe the Oklahoma natural gas producers in the field acted wrongly. He does think there was some manipulation done in the middle part in the marketing. And so he's going after that. He's also made a distinction in these lawsuits in Osage County that there is a difference between regulating prices on an intrastate pipeline system, which is a natural gas pipelines that only stay in the state and distribute gas from the wellhead to the final customer, and the actual interstate pipelines that's regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. He basically said, look, there's lots of rules on the federal side for interstate pipelines, not as many rules on the intrastate inside the state. And that is a possibility place where he's looking for possible manipulation.
Now, you mentioned earlier that Drummond filed lawsuits on behalf of the Grand River Dam Authority, which is a utility. Are customers going to see any relief on their bills? That's who's paying this.
That's right. Yeah. And this pair of lawsuits, this is limited to the GRDA. And so it would affect their customers if it's actually successful at the end of the day. Now, there are plans that Drummond says to file additional lawsuits. It's too early to say if they will involve the largest utilities in the state, which cover, you know, more than 85% of the population, Oklahoma Natural Gas, Public Service Company of Oklahoma, and Oklahoma Gas and Electric. They had billions in natural gas costs during that storm. Their customers are paying the biggest chunk of this. And there are clawback mechanisms in the bonds that were sold for those that allow for any kind of judgments after the fact to be taken off the principal for those bonds. But of course, we're still paying interest payments as well over decades for those customers. You're basically getting charged $10 to $15 extra per month for the next 25 to 28 years in some cases.
All right. Well, thanks, Paul. You can read all of Paul's coverage of those lawsuits and everything else related to the spike in natural gas prices caused by Winter Storm Uri. You'll find it all on our website at oklahomawatch.org. Keaton Ross covers democracy and criminal justice at Oklahoma Watch. He recently reported that most state legislative races will not appear on November's general election ballot. Keaton, what percentage of state House and Senate races are uncontested?
Around 40% are going entirely uncontested, which means that not only will they not appear on the November ballot, they also won't appear on any sort of primary election ballot because just one candidate filed for office.
Now, were all these incumbents who filed for another term?
All but one. There was one case, Senate District in Eastern Oklahoma, where former Representative Avery Fricks, who left his state House seat to run for Congress in 2022, filed for a Senate seat that's being vacated by an incumbent, Dwayne Pemberton, and no one else filed for that seat. So essentially filing day, he won that election for an entire Senate seat.
Now, what about races where candidates from only one party filed for office?
There were a little over a quarter of all the races up for re-election. I don't have the exact number, somewhere in the mid-30s will be decided in single-party primaries. Of course, in Democratic primaries, the Democratic Party has allowed this election cycle independents to participate in that. But in the Republican primaries, those are reserved only for registered Republicans. So only certain, depending on your party affiliation, you might not be able to vote in those primary elections that will happen. There'll be the June primary as well as the August runoff, depending on the results of that.
How does that compare with previous election cycles? We've done stories in the past about the lack of people filing for office, but how does this particular cycle stack up?
It's pretty comparable to the 2022 election cycle. I wrote a pretty lengthy story about some of the the issues at play there, why candidates aren't running, and sort of the effects, the trickle down effects of that. There were, I believe, maybe two or three more contested races this year compared to 2022, but overall, pretty comparable to the last major statewide election cycle. And that has continued to the number of contested races has been on a going from 2018 to 2022. There's a pretty substantial decline there. So major decline in 2022, and that has held up here in 2024.
Maybe you can explain a little bit why does it matter, right? Why, if nobody runs, saves us an extra trip to the polls, right? Why does it matter if there are fewer candidates?
So one of the main, I've done several interviews on this and had several conversations, and something that's come up fairly regularly is that if there's not a state house race or a state senate race, these are candidates that are pretty likely to knock on your door or send flyers or reach out to you in some way. Maybe they're going to be much more accessible in most cases than someone who's running for president or even a statewide office in a lot of cases. That allows them to have conversations and sort of see what is important to their constituency and build those relationships. And there's a concern that if they don't have to go out there and earn their vote necessarily, that can cause some distance between voters and their elected officials, and is not the best case scenario for a Democratic government. So there's that aspect of it. And that's something that has come up a lot.
What about the, roadblocks and deterrence? What is it that keeps people from filing for office?
It's a pretty intense job, really. I mean, it's if you're looking at being competitive in even a state house race that has, maybe 38,000, 39,000 people living in the district, that requires raising several thousand dollars and going out and knocking doors and sort of trying to build that name recognition. And if you're someone who's working a full-time job or have other commitments, that's a pretty big commitment. And, of course, that's as far as the money being raised, that's accelerated some in recent election cycles. Of course, it's always been a pretty big time commitment. So that's one element. Another element is just sort of the nationalization we've seen of local politics, local races, where sort of national issues and ideas are being injected into these local races. So, if you have someone who's a registered Democrat who maybe a decade or 15 years ago could have ran a competitive race as sort of an old school Democrat, in a lot of cases now there might be attack ads where they're being tied to Joe Biden or Nancy Pelosi or some sort of national Democrat that maybe doesn't align totally with their ideology. So that's another factor we've seen as particularly the number of Democrats registering to run for office has declined.
And, what's out there that might be able to help that? Anybody talking about any policy changes or anything that might give voters a little more voice?
There have been a few ideas floating out there as far as proposed legislation and maybe even a proposed state question. One would be a retention ballot has been it was a bill that Representative Andy Fugate from Del City filed last year, never got a hearing. But the idea of that would be that if the legislator was uncontested, their name would appear on the November ballot on a retention ballot. And if they didn't get at least 50%, I think 51% of people to check yes on their retention ballot, there would be a special election called. So that's one idea that hasn't got much traction, but has been put out there. The other is the idea of implementing open primaries, which would put all candidates on the June primary ballot, and anyone of any party could vote on them. And then the top two, regardless of party, would advance to the November general election. The idea of that is that it might increase interest, participation from independents, people who may not be on a far side of either political spectrum. So that there have been some conversations of organizers wanting to get a state question on the ballot for that issue. We're still a pretty far away from that, but will be something to watch.
How about the U.S. House races? Are there any congressional seats that will fail to appear on the November ballot?
Yes, there is the U.S. House, the third congressional district that covers a lot of rural western and northern Oklahoma, as well as recently with redistricting part of urban South Oklahoma City, that the incumbent Frank Lucas has a few challengers in the Republican primary, but no Democrat or independent or libertarian filed. So if he manages to pull out of that primary as an incumbent, he will keep that seat for another 2 years.
All right. Well, thanks, Keaton. You can read all of Keaton's coverage of state government, democracy, and criminal justice. You'll find it on our website, oklahomawatch.org. While you're there, don't miss the chance to sign up for Keaton's weekly newsletter, Democracy Watch. You've been listening to Long Story Short, a weekly podcast that helps you get deeper into the investigative stories reported by Oklahoma Watch, which you can find on the web at oklahomawatch.org. This episode was recorded at the AT&T Podcast Studio. For Oklahoma Watch, I'm Ted Strooley. Thanks for listening.